I'm Grady, and this is my column on architecture, The Professional Architect. A few years ago, I was busy not dying. As it turns out, every male in my family had earlier died of a nasty complex condition called an aneurysm of the ascending aorta. In the spring of 2004, my 20-year-old nephew died suddenly after a vigorous workout. No one saw it coming. It's a nasty condition because the primary symptom of an aneurysm is death, which is not especially predictive. It's a complex condition because of its location in the circulatory system. You have to fiddle with the arteries that lead directly to the brain, so the chance of cognitive loss from an operation to repair this genetic defect is not small. Being a person who lives in my head, it was a very real cost-benefit analysis that I had to consider. Every 3 months, I would schlep to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, New York, and undergo an ultrasound, a CT scan, and an occasional MRI. In 2006, we studied the latest 3D image of my plumbing, decided that things just didn't look right, and so I went under the knife. The physical recovery took 9 months. The emotional and spiritual recovery continues. Believe me, the Mayo Clinic is one automated place. The number of transistors per square inch is extraordinarily high, and their doctors and staff are top-notch. I must be clear to mention, thank you, Dr. Sunt, for keeping me alive. So, geek that I am, I would get a little bit bored while lying in the ultrasound CT-MRI lab. I'd occupy myself by considering the nature of all the software-intensive GORP that surrounded me. I recall once glancing up at the logo on the CT machine into which I was being ingested, pausing and then realizing, I know the people who wrote the software for this machine. That realization gave me pause. People whom I would likely never meet face-to-face had written software that was keeping me alive. As I then considered all the other software-intensive systems around me, I also realized that there was a lot of other software in which my life depended. The monitors, the blood analysis system, the information systems that watched over me, the machines that manufactured the drugs that I would take, the systems that controlled the anesthesia flowing into me, taking over the operation of my heart, cooling down my body. The list goes on. I happily surrendered myself, my very life, to that software, and of course to the doctors and staff who use those software-intensive systems. But it's not just me alone. It's something that each of us does every day in contemporary society. We expect the anti-lock brakes, the automated ignition system, and the navigation system in our cars to work. We expect the banks to keep our money safe. Well, we can at least hope we'll be able to put our trust in their software-intensive systems. We depend on the elevators we ride, the software that processes and tracks the ingredients of the food we eat, the avionics systems of the planes we fly to all the functions properly. The list goes on. So, how do these complex systems spring into being? I had a most delightful conversation with Ed Feigenbaum a few months ago, talking about the stories of computing. Ed observed that, in the end, there were only two fundamental realities. It's all ones and zeros at the bottom, and everything above is full of human stories. Computer science focuses more on the realm of the ones and zeros, but for software engineering, it extends to the delicious dance between the technical and the social, between the ones and the zeros and the human stories. So, while all those machines that kept me alive were ultimately only ones and zeros at the bottom, it's how we organize those bits and how we organize the humans who develop, deliver, deploy, evolve those systems that are at the heart of software engineering. There are some things we know about organizing those bits in meaningful ways. As Dave Parnas noticed, as a rule, software systems do not work well until they have been used and have failed repeatedly in real applications. John Gall observes, a complex system that works is inevitably found to have evolved from a simpler system that works. Herbert Simon notes, both vertically and horizontally, the most resilient systems tend to exhibit loose coupling and tight cohesion among components. Dick Gabriel writes that simplicity is the most important consideration in a design. Both implementation and interface must be simple, though it is more important for the implementation to be simple. Adam Bosworth states that software which is flexible, simple, sloppily tolerant, and altogether forgiving turns out to actually be the more steel cord, able to survive and grow. And finally, Alexander Calder remarks that to an engineer, good enough means perfect. Let's consider those engineers for a moment. Most economically interesting systems spring from the vision of one person, but then require a cast of dozens or hundreds to make them real. Facebook began as a modest PHP application on Mark Zuckerberg's personal laptop. Cisco's iOS started life as a several thousand-ish C app written by one person. Adobe's Photoshop began as a labor of love of two brothers. IBM's Watson sprang from the vision of one person. The list goes on. This may sound like heresy, but for each of these systems, the raw running naked code is the most important artifact. Everything else, models, requirements, documents, test cases, you name it, is secondary or even tertiary. But let me be clear, this did not mean that models, requirements, documents, or test cases are irrelevant. They help the teams deliver the right software at the right time with the right resources. The most beautiful, the most elegant, the most useful software-intensive systems I have studied all arose from a process that permits a balance and a flow among three central activities of innovation, namely discovery, invention, and implementation. Brand Selleck once sketched, on the back of the proverbial napkin, a diagram for Philippe Krustian that illustrates how the process of development was one of overlapping cycles of these three activities. Very high ceremony processes tend to sequentialize these activities, which is sometimes appropriate, but only if, using Parnas's approach, you fake this process. Very low ceremony processes make these activities overlap completely, which is something useful if you're trying to create something you've never done before. But in my experience, you must find the right balance of those three that fits the culture of your particular development team and that reconciles the static and dynamic forces in your system. The amateur software developer is always in search of magic to find that balance, be it the right framework or the right tool or the right process. Such a search is a fool's errand. The professional software engineer recognizes that there is no magic, there is no silver bullet. In my experience, bullets are altogether the wrong ammunition in the first place. If you happen to be a fan of the trilogy The Matrix, you may recall a riff by the architect in which he notes, "The first Matrix I designed was quite naturally perfect. It was a work of art, flawless, sublime, a triumph equaled only by its monumental failure." What I take away from this scene applies to the life of the professional software engineer as well. Perfection is the enemy of good enough. Don't be bound by your models, but then again, don't let your code collapse into disorganized complexity by not having any models or patterns or intentional architectural decisions that would otherwise give it structure. Software engineering, much like science, is a self-correcting process when properly carried out. A process that short-circuits the checks and balances of a discovery, invention, implementation process may work in the short term, but will fail in the long term. And by the way, I plan on not dying for a long time. So I'd rather the software in which my life depends be tuned to the long needs.